final case this morning is number 21-1262, Sanofi-Avantis versus Mylan. Mr. Banks again. We've already had a fair amount of argument about written description, so it's not necessary to repeat what we've gone through so far.
Okay, appreciate that, Your Honor. So this morning, this is the appeal from the district court infringement decision. I'll focus on the infringement issues. I'm happy to address the written description issues as well as they arise. To the extent the court has questions, the records are different and there are some differences. But starting with the infringement issues, I think that it's clear to understand, and this is what the district court itself said, that the case for infringement doesn't turn on any disputed facts. It's about how the facts apply to the infringement arguments. And here, the district court misconstrued the claim language by adding limitations in each case that just simply aren't there in the claim language. And I'd like to start with Claim 21 and the limitation that the sleeve is releasably connected to the dose indicator. There's no dispute that in the Vistra, when a user presses the button to engage, to inject a dose, the Vistra setback, which is its sleeve, is connected to the dose set knob, which is indicator. And then when the user releases her finger from the button, the connection between the two components is released. That's enough to demonstrate that the components are releasably connected. They are releasably connected during dose administration.
So can I ask if this is, this has confused me and I remain confused. So put aside for 1 minute that this is just a 271E2 case, right?
Correct.
Okay, put aside from that. In the ordinary 271 ABC case, you would first of all religiously avoid, if you were noticing that there was a problem here, language about products infringing. Products don't infringe under 271 A, B, and C. Actions by defendants infringe. And you would ask, well, when Sanofi makes this thing, is it making something where the things are connected? Answer, no. Maybe in testing, it would be using it where, not Sanofi, the other side. And you would ask, is the selling a form of contributory infringement? Because there's only one use. Every single one of these things that's used at all is going to at some point be a device covered by the thing and the patient will be using it. I don't see any discussion of that sort of analysis, which 271 A, B, and C provide for in the papers here. And I want help understanding whether that kind of analysis has any bearing on a 271 E2 analysis.
Right. So I think Your Honor has identified sort of two separate issues. And I think the easier one is to look at the E2 situation because the act of infringement here is submitting an application where the use of the commercial use of the device would infringe. And so there's no question
is that the language of E2?
That's like, I don't have the E2 in front of me, but it's something to that effect, which is it's an act of infringement to submit an application for the commercial use of the drug product where the drug product would infringe the patent. I can pull up the language on
the use of which is claimed in a patent.
Correct. And
well, the use is not claimed. This is a product claim.
I think it's the tag along of the, I don't have it in front of me, but it's, you have A, B, C, you have the E, and then you have what follows after the parentheticals where I believe it says for the commercial use of the product, will infringe. And the point being, there's no dispute that when the pen is used, it infringes. And then
I agree with what you say that started. How things occur is undisputed. The question is entirely the legal characterization of that. And that's why if you got something to say about 271E2, that's to me is where the action is.
Correct. And that's our view that's what makes it even cleaner. But even putting that aside to answer your question about ABC, the cases are clear that a device that infringes part of the time still infringes and that you have
devices
to look
don't
at
infringe.
The nature of
that. Devices that don't infringe.
Well, a device encompassing components that read on the claim language will infringe. And beyond that, the You have to look at the nature of the infringing product. And the nature here of the product is that it's going to be used to inject medication. It's not going to sit in its packaging at a store as a district court found. The nature of the product is that it's going to be used to inject medication, and when the product is so used, the components will be connected. If an infringer could avoid infringement simply by packaging their product differently, that just certainly can't be correct. If they could avoid infringement by packaging them in one configuration versus another, when it's clear that for the product to be used, it will infringe, that would be an untenable result. I think it's telling that to make the case for infringement work here, both the district court and Mylan have to read releasably connected to mean connected in their resting or default state. And that's simply not what the plain language of connected means. Connected, it implies that they are joined, but doesn't set a limitation on when those things are connected or disconnected. And it's clear that they are both connected at the time of injection, and that's enough to meet the claim limitation. If I could move on to the next limitation, Your Honor, this is a part of Claim 21 as well. It requires a piston rod holder that is configured to prevent rotation of the piston rod during dose setting. The undisputed facts resolve this matter too. There's no dispute that a keyed connection.
I just want to return to this one. So the language I think you were referring to is at the end of E2 before you get to 3, and it lists ABC, if the purpose of the submission is to obtain approval under the Act to engage in the commercial manufacture, use, or sale of blah, blah, blah. The only one, as far as I can tell, who's ever using a device that meets the claim requirements is the patient. I wouldn't call that a commercial use, would you?
Well, I think it's the patient, but also Mylan and testing and getting and seeking even approval for
the drug. Did you ever say anything about testing? I don't remember this ever coming up.
If you look at the NDA itself, and I think if you look at this is not appendix.
No, but in the district court, I don't remember any mention. I don't know all of your papers.
Sure.
But the district or in your briefing here, any reference to Mylan or whatever, whoever the company is that makes this thing for Mylan, testing as part of the analysis.
It's evident from we refer to the NDA, I think, as demonstrating how the product will be used. And part of that, if you look at NDA at Appendix 22120 and following, there's a long description of the approval process, including testing. So it's certainly part of the record. But more to the point, the nature of this product is not something that's going to sit on the shelves.
Ones who are transforming it into a device that meets the requirement are not doing it commercially.
I would direct Your Honor to the fantasy sports case, for example, right? Which is a case where it didn't infringe literally the claim until a user is a computer game. It didn't infringe until the user started playing the game, right? So it was still an act of infringement to sell the product, even though it didn't literally infringe until the user pressed on, for example.
Was that contributory or induced infringement?
I don't believe it was contributory or induced infringement, Your Honor. That's my understanding of the case. If I can turn back to the piston rod holder limitation. There's no dispute that there is a key connection in the Vistra that exists at all times between its tower core, which is its piston rod holder, and its plunger rod, which is the piston rod. The two can never rotate. The piston rod can never rotate. It's snapped together. The district court recognized this in its findings. I directed the court to Appendix 71. It specifically found that the tower core has a capacity to prevent the plunger rod from rotating. In finding non-infringement, the district court again added an additional limitation here. And this would be characterized as a causation requirement, that the rotation that's prevented be caused by the dose setting operation. That language is not present. If you look at the 43 of the board's decision, I think it's a clear example of how the board reached this conclusion. It found that the tower core does not prevent the transmission of rotational force during dose setting. But again, that's not the claim language. The claim language is, does it prevent rotation during dose setting, full stop. The keyed connection does this. It prevents rotation at all times. And again, the district court added to the claim language by requiring that causation element. The district court did find that a separate component, the setback, was configured to prevent rotation during dose setting because it interrupted the rotational flow. Again, even if that were so, it doesn't change the outcome. There's nothing in the claim language that limits the rotation to only one component as preventing rotation. The undisputed fact remains that there's never rotation of the plunger rod at any time because they're keyed together, and so it therefore meets the claim language. I think the district court compounded its error even further with a factual one, finding that gravity didn't exert rotational forces. And again, here the only evidence in the record is that it does. Putting aside physics, you have an experiment on the one hand that Dr. Reinholz did that demonstrated when the keyed connection was removed, there was rotation. And you even have the expert on the other side admitting it, and this is admitting that that the gravitational forces, he used the gravitational forces to produce rotation. So there's no dispute that without the tower core and the key connection, there would be rotation. So that's what satisfies that claim limitation as well. Just quickly, if I can turn to the written description issues here, I think, you know, the affirmative case that we argued is substantially similar to what we went through this morning. I would say that the district court here went wrong by analyzing the case under an enablement standard. It asked whether the design choices necessary to make or use an injector pen would be numerous and complicated. That's an enablement standard, and separately, the court found that the claim was enabled in findings that Mylan doesn't challenge on appeal. And its error in this regard, I think, affected...
Why isn't it relevant to written description that it's difficult to implement the alternative, and that in terms of someone envisioning that invention being in the possession of the inventors, that the difficulty of implementing it is relevant?
I think it's important to look at the reasons why the court said it was difficult. It said it was difficult, or it said complicated. And the reason it said it is because a person would have to figure out, you know, what type of plastic to use, how long to make the stinger, and so forth. These are sort of manufacturing details, none of which was disclosed with respect to the embodiment that they agree was adequately disclosed in the patent. So it sort of demanded more than what was necessary to show written description, more than what this court's cases have said is necessary to show written description. And by the way, it found that those things actually weren't all that unduly complicated because it found that the claim was properly enabled. So it looking at it through that lens led the court down a path of errors in concluding that the written description test wasn't met here. I think it's important to look at the record as it relates to the actual testimony, as the actual language of the disclosure, which is, again, the key, you know, of the written description analysis, is what does the disclosure say? And as to that, you had the court finding that Dr. Slocum's description of the description in the patent was even broader than what Dr. Slocum said it was. It's on page 53 of the opinion. And then Mr. Leinsing, who's the expert on the other side, didn't address the disclosure language at all, except for one conclusory sentence in which he said it wasn't described. So look on the record, right, which is what is important here. Now, on the record as it relates to what the actual disclosures are, here I think the case was overwhelming that the disclosure was satisfied. I see I've got a few minutes left for my rebuttal time. I'm happy to address
that. We have less than 2 minutes, but we'll give you 2 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Carsten?
I had to look at my watch. It still is good morning. So good morning, and may it please the court. This is the appeal on the district court decision. Judge Chesler heard 3-4 days of testimony, had hours with these witnesses, pored over the record, and issued his decision, finding written description violation here, as well as 4 different bases of non-infringement, 2 of which independently would also dispatch of the entirety of this appeal. So The court has before it three separate grounds upon which it could affirm Judge Chesler's decision, the written description decision, the releasably connected, or the configured to prevent rotation during dose setting. Your Honor seemed most interested in the infringement aspects when you were asking questions of my learned colleague. I'm happy to jump there. I would simply note that there is really no evidence that Judge Chesler was confused on the written description part about the enablement standard. We know that from the decision itself. Judge Chesler had before him enablement as well as written description and found oppositely between the two. And we disagree with his decision in connection with the enablement, but had he simply misapplied and applied the enablement standard for written description, he would have had the same result for both, and that's not what happened below. With respect to the infringement, Sanofi is stuck with their claim language, and they chose the words releasably connected. They didn't choose connectable, which they very well might have. That would have, of course, raised written description and enablement issues in and of itself. But Mylan's device...
Can you just help me on what, yes. And I may be the only one, on what I'm spent a fair bit of time with your friend on the other side with. I keep asking myself the question, what statutory provision are we dealing with here? I think we're dealing with 271E2. The facts seem to be undisputed. As sold, the claim elements are not met in your product. As used, let's assume for current purposes, every single time they are met. Now, it seems to me there's no factual question here about infringement. There's a question about the governing legal standards, and yet I don't see any discussion of 271E2 except I think your brief says, by the way, this is a 271E2 case, and then you're on to talking about other things. So help me understand how to think about these undisputed facts under the statutory regime here for so-called infringement.
Well, you're absolutely right, Your Honor. I did pull up the language of 271E2. It shall be an act of infringement to submit an application under, and I'm omitting words, 505B2, of such for a drug claimed or the use of which is claimed in a patent, and neither the drug, which is the insulin glargine drug product.
So why are we under 272E2 at all?
That's a very good question, Your Honor.
I thought your brief refers to some other statute that says something like this goes, I didn't follow it.
It's a good question under 271E2. There were some claims under 271A, B, and C that were raised by Sanofi below. There was a motion to dismiss them, which I believe was never ruled upon. So it's possible that 271A, B, and C are still in play and live in the record below. I'd need to look to check and see if that's the case. Having said that, though, there was no commercial sale. This is a Hatch-Waxman case.
Commercial use.
Right. So there was no
commercial sale.
Oh, I'm sorry. There was no commercial. Well, there was no commercial sale as of the time that the case was being litigated.
No. But the statute depends on the objective.
Right. Fair enough.
Do you really think that commercial use, as referenced in E2, is avoided because it's a consumer using it as opposed to it's being sold for a use that would infringe?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it infringes while the consumer uses it.
A different question. But the question we were dealing with is whether the commercial use language of the statute reaches a situation in which a manufacturer is selling a device which, when used by the consumer, would infringe, and whether that constitutes sale for commercial use. It just seems to me a little unlikely that the statute wasn't designed to include a situation that I just described.
Well, it certainly sets forth an artificial act of infringement such that the court is able to look to how the drug product would be used. And that's often the case where you have a method of use claim, for example, as well in the case. It so happens that the case that the claims that went to trial here are simply device claims, and odd device claims in the sense that you don't typically see medical device claims in connection with a Hatch-Waxman case. It's typically the drug product. Now, Sanofi has taken Sanofi has taken the view here that that it is somehow authorized to list these patents which deal with the, I'm going to call it the packaging, although it is the device that administers the drug product, but it is not the drug product itself under the Patent Act. Now, Mylan, or any defendant that's faced with such a circumstance has an option to go ahead and try to file for delisting or make a claim for delisting of such claims. But remember, the purpose of the Hatch-Waxman Act is to try to get patent clarity. So that way you're not in a situation where you clear the patent, you clear the patent thicket and then you launch your product and you're suddenly facing additional patent litigation under A, B, and C. And so in this instance, Mylan opted not to try to delist the claims to get that patent clarity and certainty under 271E. But remind you, I also understand that Sanofi did have 271 A, B, and C claims here, which we moved to dismiss and the court never ruled on, is my recollection. And so, I think that Sanofi was trying to say 271E under Hatch-Waxman, and then as it came time for commercial launch, we could transfer over to A, B, and C, or if there were commercial launch.
Right, but a 271C, or actually A, B, and C all are, pretty plausible here. C in particular. If you make and sell a product, which as far as I can tell from the record, the arguments, meets every claim limitation in every single use by the consumer. How is that not a 271C? And yet I don't see any reference to 271C below.
Well, that's a failure of proof of Sanofi.
Obviously, there are knowledge requirements and stuff. I'm not sure how hard that would be here, but...
Well, Sanofi could have made this into a 271C.
You just said that there were 271C claims in the case.
At trial, they could have offered evidence to substantiate and support that. They chose not to. And this is a failure of proof on Sanofi's end. So I disagree with the hypothetical or the conclusion that at some point this product, that the Vistra pen will infringe each and every element. I don't think that's the case at all. But even assuming if it were.
But the only basis on which the district court said no infringement is that as sold, there's an element that's not met.
The court applied a claim construction.
He didn't doubt, right, that when the button is pushed down and the thing is injected at the, that at that point that element is met. That I didn't understand that to be in dispute. Is it?
I thought the claim construction was the device at rest is disconnected. It is the opposite of what is claimed and disclosed. And I don't think the court made a finding at all about the infringement during use or whether it would infringe during use. In fact, the claim construction, which required an analysis of the pen at rest, because of the past tense releasably connected language and not connectable language, made the determination or the infringement scope about the product as it sits. And I think that's ably supported by the record here and the claim language that Sanofi voluntarily elected to pursue. When Sanofi wanted to talk about how the pen is operating during dose setting, dialing up, dialing down, they did so. When Sanofi in that claim wanted to talk about what the device does during dose administration, during injection, they did so. Here, there's a claim limitation that doesn't talk about dose setting. It doesn't talk about dose administration. It simply says releasably connected in the past tense. And that's a finding of no infringement under that claim. And that non-infringement under the claim does not change simply because or during the use of the claim. And maybe that's why we didn't see so much of an analysis under A, B, or under B or C. also would be a failure proof of Sanofi. They should have, in their post-trial brief, said, hey, judge, we have a B or C issue. We have an inducement or contributory infringement, and here's the evidentiary record to support it. They didn't do that.
Or an A claim for testing.
An A claim for testing, that you're quibbling around on whether it falls within the experimental use exception if that testing is designed to give rise to an FDA submission, right? So I think it's more the B and C than the A necessarily, right? Because there's nobody saying that Mylan is running around injecting patients with this pen. It's the patients themselves or their caregivers who presumably would be injecting them. And that was on Sanofi to do. It's their burden of proof. And they failed to do it. So, and secondly, even if we get past the releasably connected, even if you all think, okay, you know, Judge Chesler, very smart guy, but he happened to get this one wrong. You have the second, which is the, you know, configured to prevent rotation during dose setting. The judge heard all of the evidence on this. He watched and heard from the experts and made credibility determinations about the cut up and incorrectly, rebuilt pen that omitted elements. And that was the foundational testimony that Sanofi relied upon in order to convince the judge that there was infringement under that claim limitation. That's not a claim construction issue. That was their attempt to meet the claim language that everyone understood to be plain and ordinary meaning. And they failed under Judge Chesler's based upon Judge Chesler's credibility determinations and weighing of the evidence. And that's entitled to deference here, with respect. But there's no suggestion that Judge Chesler, that is an attempt, as we've seen repeatedly throughout the morning today, of Sanofi to take a factual finding that it disagrees with and try to dress it up into a legal framework violation clothing. And you know, it is the classic throw the plate of spaghetti against the wall and hope that a noodle sticks. But there are significant factual findings here that ably support Judge Chesler's finding on that second basis, which itself is an independent basis for non-infringement. I understand the releasably connected language, but that is language of Sanofi's choice. They chose to go past tense. They chose to describe the invention based upon the specification in the way that they did. Judge Chesler considered that intrinsic evidence. He heard from the witnesses. He reached his claim construction determination. And I believe the claim construction determination based upon the claim language alone and then in view of the specification is exactly how the claim ought to be read. So I disagree, Judge Taranto, with the predicate of the assessment, and that is that during administration, the pen will be in an infringing configuration. Under Judge Chesler's construction, which I believe to be correct, I don't think that's the accurate analysis. Because the pen at rest under the construction, must be connected under the construction, and Mylan's pen indisputably is disconnected at rest, and will always be so.
Okay. Anything further?
I have 45 seconds on the clock, but I'm happy to field any 42-second questions that the panel may have.
Okay. I think we're done.
Thank you, Mr.
Thurston.
And again, thank you again this morning.
Okay. Mr. Banks, 2 minutes.
Just quickly, Your Honors, on the E2 point, I mean, the idea that we have a failure of proof. I mean, the reason this was an E2 case is that there wasn't an authorized sale of the product yet. So that's that's why there aren't claims that were live at trial as it relates to A, B, and C. I think on the language there, again, I think the court's claim construction was that connected meant connected at a resting state, and that simply is just not in the claim language. The claim language just says releasably connected, and I don't think there's any factual dispute that the pieces are connected when the pen is used as it's intended to be. And so that resolves that issue. On the piston rod configured to prevent rotation, counsel referred to the factual findings there with respect to the experiment that our expert did. I think respectfully, the district court, again, just got this backwards. If you look at appendix page 40, the court identifies the pertinent question as whether it were not for the tower cord keys connection if the plunger rod would rotate during dose setting. And that's exactly what the experiment showed. He then criticizes it because no one contends that the key connection gets removed during the operation of pen. But of course, that's the entire point. In an operating pen, there is the key connection, and our experts show that when the key connection is gone, it's missing. And there's nothing, it rotates. And there's nothing in the district court's opinion that shows that that's wrong. He just sort of mixed up his own tests in that respect. Finally, I think just with respect to the sort of overall nature of these appeals, I think that the point I want to emphasize is that there were four specific claims that were infringed in this case, and district court said that based on the plain language based on the testimony and the evidence here, there's no dispute as a matter of the facts. This really is about how the law applies to the facts here, and it's not at all. A suggestion that we're trying to transform factual disputes into legal ones based on the district court's sort of own understanding of the district court's own factual findings here. The language of the claims demonstrates that the Vistra infringes the patent.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Banks. Thank you, Mr. Parston. Case is submitted. That concludes our session for this morning.